This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Blaine Harden, a reporter for PBS's Frontline, a contributor to The Economist, and a former foreign correspondent for The Washington Post. Blaine is author of Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent, and the New York Times bestseller, Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Odyssey from North Korea. Blaine Harden is here today to tell us about his book, A River Lost, The Life and Death of the Columbia, originally published in 1996 and revised and updated in 2012. Welcome, Blaine.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
What led you to write the original version of your book?
I'd been in Bosnia and in Yugoslavia for the Washington Post, and I needed to come home. My mother was ill. I grew up in Moses Lake over in the east side. So I was searching for a project, actually, to justify living around Moses Lake for a year or two. And at the time, the Columbia had turned into this incredibly disputatious river system. The people who dammed it were accused of killing all the salmon, of being insensitive. The people who built Hanford were accused of secretly poisoning their neighbors. And there was a big public resource war going on up and down the river. So it seemed like a perfect way to come home and find something to do. And so I got a book contract from Norton and then came and traveled up and down the river for about a year writing about the dams. And I have a real personal connection to Hanford and the dams. My father worked at Grand Coulee Dam when it was originally constructed and later when it was expanded in the 70s. And I also worked there when I was in college, and I got fired for being a smartass, talking too much when I should have been working. And my father worked at Hanford as well. And the wages from those jobs, they were federal jobs, and they were good wages. My father was a construction welder. They provided our family with a middle-class life and me with enough money to go to college.
Why did you decide to revise the book in 2012?
Well, two reasons. Some things had changed, not in the dams. Nothing much has changed with the dams. But in the way the river's perceived and in some of the conditions around the world regarding global warming and the value of hydroelectricity because it's clean and green, and also some of the users of the electricity had changed, and I'll talk about that later. But also PBS did a special on Grand Coulee Dam that was aired in April called Grand Coulee Dam, and they asked me to be a participant, and I helped them actually to sort of shape the program a little bit. And so I decided as I was doing that the book needed a revision, and so I did it.
What was the Columbia River like before the dams were built?
Well, it was the largest and most impressive salmon highway on Earth. When Lewis and Clark came in the early part of the 19th century, they discovered a river that was almost so full of salmon that you could almost walk on the fish across the river. Traveling down the river in their attempt to find a Northwest Passage, when they discovered the river and then walked and canoed down it, they got so sick of eating salmon, because there were salmon everywhere coming out their ears, that they would very often try to eat dog instead of salmon for the variety, because the salmon was driving them crazy. There was so much of it. And what's happened with this incredible salmon highway is that it's been not destroyed, but fundamentally crippled because of the dams, which have limited mostly downstream passage for small salmon. The big killer, of course, was Grand Coulee Dam, which was built in the late 30s and was finished in the early 40s. It did not have fish ladders. So fish could not go up it, fish did not come down. And so a third of the river, including the biggest fish, the June hogs they were called, big Chinook salmon, they were made extinct overnight when the dam was complete. There was no consideration given to the fish at that time or to the people who lived on them, the Colville tribe above the dam.
What were the key motivations for building dams on the Columbia?
The key motivation for building the Grand Coulee Dam was two things. One, it was during the Great Depression, and Roosevelt was looking for a project that would provide jobs, which the Grand Coulee did. It provides several thousand jobs in the middle of nowhere. And they were also looking for a way to produce really cheap power, which Grand Coulee did and does. It's still the largest hydroelectric plant in North America, and it still produces a very large percentage of all the power consumed in the Pacific Northwest. The decision to build that dam, of course, killed the salmon and it devastated the Colville tribe. But it's had a good effect on the Pacific Northwest. It's given cheap power, which helped do several things. It was the pump that primed the wealth that Boeing created in Seattle, cheap power for the manufacture of airplanes during World War II. It also provided cheap power to Hanford during World War II for the manufacture of plutonium, which produced the second bomb dropped over Japan. And it also was the power behind the Cold War buildup. Most of the plutonium used in Americans' nuclear arsenal was made at Hanford using power from Grand Coulee Dam. Besides that, it brought aluminum factories to the Pacific Northwest. And manufacturing bloomed all across the region because of the cheap power. And that led, over time, the development of software, Microsoft, and now Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, they've all marched back down to the river to build server farms, giant, giant warehouses full of air-conditioned servers that use cheap power from the Columbia River dams to provide services to almost everybody on Earth. What's happened in the past 10 years with the construction of those server farms is really a new development on the river, and it's given almost everybody who uses a smartphone or a laptop a stake in the damming of the river.
Would you comment also on the influence of irrigation water from the Columbia on farming in eastern Washington?
Part of the Grand Coulee Dam project was to create a big irrigation system, which it did. It took about 10 years after the construction of the dam before the irrigation system started and another 20 years before it was completed. But the Columbia Basin Irrigation Project opened up a big swath of desert in eastern Washington to agriculture that grows everything from mint to alfalfa to fruit, and it's been a big boon to eastern Washington. It was to have been 1 million acres big, which is a very large project. It's already the largest all-federal irrigation project in the United States. But the project was built, half of it was built, about 580,000 acres, and then it stopped. And it stopped because there were estimates that the water used for irrigation would be better used if it were kept in the river because it would produce more valuable electricity and it would bring back fish. And so the expansion of the project was halted in the 80s. Now, because of a worldwide shortage of food, which is projected to increase, particularly in Asia as populations grow and their appetites for different kinds of food grow, there's issues about maybe expanding the project again. With better irrigation technology, they're using less water to grow more food. So that's very much a possibility now. That possibility did not exist in the mid-90s when I finished the book.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Blaine Harden, author of the book, A River Lost, The Life and Death of the Columbia. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you comment on the role that federal subsidies played in building dams and providing infrastructure for irrigation in eastern Washington?
Federal money paid for it all. The state of Washington had Scoop Jackson and Ward Magnuson, two of the longest-serving Western senators ever. And they were in a position to rain federal money on eastern Washington, which they did in an unprecedented quantities. There was more money going to water projects per capita in eastern Washington than anywhere else in the United States. And that continued for about 30, 40 years. The result of that was that irrigation farmers, of whom there really weren't very many in the Columbia Basin, they received enormous subsidies, several thousand dollars per acre, to grow food that wasn't worth nearly as much. There were estimates made that if they took the subsidies for the average farm, which amounted to about a couple $1 million, and just put it in the bank or put it in a mutual fund, they would earn more money than they earned from growing food on the farm. But in any case, the federal government made this decision to create a so-called planned promised land for average farmers, many of whom were returning World War II veterans. What happened, though, is that a lot of these farmers were not very good farmers, and they went broke. And there was a consolidation built into the system where the successful farmers got bigger. And what ended up happening by the 1980s is this enormous amount of federal spending was subsidizing relatively profitable middle to upper middle class farmers. And it sort of didn't pass the test of social equity at some point. And so the federal government and the state of Washington ratcheted back the subsidies, although they're still there. They still pay well below cost for electricity and for water, although they do grow a very substantial amount of food.
You alluded earlier to the effect on Indian tribes of building the dams. Yeah. Would you say more?
Well, for several tribes on the Columbia, the coming of the dams has been devastating. The most alarming example is the Colville tribe, which is upstream from Grand Coulee Dam. When the dam was completed, the fish disappeared. And their fish-based culture, their fish-based religion, and their fish-based diet, and basically their fish-based workday, it all disappeared. And the tribe went into an awful downward spiral of alcoholism, suicide, despair, house fires, pedestrian accidents. It was a real disaster for the Colville, one that has been very much underappreciated by the people who've benefited from the cheap electricity from the dam. The Colvilles did not get cheap electricity. They did not get water from the irrigation system. In fact, it took them a long time to even get phone service after the dam was built. All the benefits went over to the Columbia Basin Project, to Moses Lake area, where I was born. I was born in 1952, and I grew up as an amnesiac beneficiary of this system. Donald Worster, who is a revisionist historian of the American West, he talks about a kind of amnesia that exists across the American West in irrigation country, where federal money has been used to divert rivers and create irrigation systems. People live there, and they don't understand why it's possible for them to have water, particularly water, or cheap electricity. They believe somehow it's due to their rugged Western individualism and their grit. But in fact, it's because decisions were made by powerful lawmakers to funnel huge amounts relative to the population, huge amounts of federal money to create a sort of land oasis. And the people there do not understand that they are the apple-eyed beneficiaries of the federal government. And strangely enough, they hate the federal government. The historian Bernard DeVoto had this wonderful line about the beneficiaries in the West of federal largesse. And their attitude towards the government is, give me more money and get out of town.
What efforts have been made to protect salmon and bring back more robust salmon runs on the Columbia?
Well, there's been a big change in the past 15 years, and that's the reason I revised my book. When I was working on the book in the early 90s, and it came out in 1996, there was real despair about what to do with the salmon runs in the Columbia River. Several species were on the edge, on the brink of extinction. Several others seemed to be headed that way, and it was unclear what could be done with all these blocks of concrete in the Columbian snake system. Could anything be done to bring back the salmon? And the biologists kept studying it, and a few of them had the idea that maybe the way to do it is to make the river more like a river. At the time, the big solution was to take fish and truck them or barge them to the sea. You basically strain them out of the river with a kind of filter at the dams, pump them into a barge or a bus or a truck, and then take them down to the mouth of the Columbia and dump them in. That system kind of worked, but it kind of didn't because a relatively large percentage of those salmon could not find their way home. They went out to sea and they never came back. But what some biologists speculated, maybe if we just turn the river back in the spring and summer time when the salmon migration is at its peak, into something resembling a real river. So they started spilling water over dams, spilling water with salmon going downstream, little smolts, 3 inches long. These fish, their biology tells them that they need to get down to the ocean in a set period of time, usually a few days to a week after they get in the main stem of the Columbia River or the snake. What was happening, though, the dams were holding them back. The river had become a series of stair-step lakes, sort of puddles between the concrete plugs. And so it took a really long time for a fish to swim between those plugs. The decision was made by some of the biologists, or a plan was made, to speed up the river, spill more water over the dams. Some experiments were done, and it seemed to work. What happened, though, was when you spill river over dams, you don't make electricity. And if you don't make electricity, you don't make any money. And so the people who sell electricity in the Pacific Northwest are utility companies. But most interestingly, the biggest marketer of electricity in the Pacific Northwest is the Bonneville Power Administration, which was created with the construction of Bonneville Dam and Grand Coulee Dam in the 30s and 40s as a way of marketing cheap electricity to people for economic benefit. But over time, BPA had become very much addicted to being able to sell lots of electricity to pay its operating costs and to keep all its utility clients happy. So BPA very much resisted the idea of spilling water over dams. It was considered a waste. What's happened, though, is that the federal courts have come in aggressively and ordered the BPA and the Army Corps of Engineers and other federal agencies that operate the dams, including the Bureau of Reclamation, to spill water. And there's a judge in Portland who is just now retiring, Judge James A. Redden, federal court judge. He has been very consistent in saying that the federal government has neglected its obligations to the river, to the fish that live in the river, and to the people who depend on those fish by favoring power marketing. And so he's ordered spill. That's what the biologists call it. And what's happened with spill in the past 4, 5, 6 years is they've seen unexpectedly robust returns of many species of salmon. Unexpected, even to the point where they're beginning to think that this could offer a useful way going forward of having a completely machined, plugged-up river, but still one that would support viable populations of salmon. So the power side of the federal government is still being forced by the federal courts to spill water, and it seems to be working. And that's an incredibly hopeful change in the operation of the river system.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Blaine Harden, author of the book, A River Lost, The Life and Death of the Columbia. Would you just touch briefly on the role the 1980 Northwest Power Act played in salmon protection?
The Power Act was the first serious early attempt to allow Indian tribes, salmon biologists, and people who worried about salmon to become an equal player in the way the river was run. Governors in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, appointed their representatives to the Power Council, and they were supposed to sit Solomon-like and make judgments about how to operate the river system so that there could be recreation, there could be power, but there could also be fish. And so the river could be revived from just being a sort of a mechanized way of producing power. It worked for a while. There was lots of very worthy documents produced, but its real power to muscle the Bonneville Power Administration, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the Bureau of Reclamation, this sort of holy triangle of federal power in the Pacific Northwest, to change the way they actually ran the river, they didn't really do it. And over the course of 15 years, the federal courts had to come in and use the power of the law to force the BPA in particular to pay more attention to fish and to use some of their own money, because the BPA sells all of the electricity produced by the federal dams, to use some of their very significant revenue to rebuild streams that had been damaged by agriculture, to re-engineer dams so that more fish would survive passage up and down. But they were often very reluctant to do so because they saw their main business, the true business of what they were about, as making as much electricity as possible.
Eliminating or breaching the dams on the Snake River has been one of the suggestions under consideration for salmon protection. Would you comment on arguments for and against breaching the Snake River dams?
The arguments against breaching the dams are that they are important for this transportation corridor that goes to Lewiston, Idaho, which provides incredibly cheap field-to-ocean transportation for farmers and manufacturers in Idaho and in eastern Washington. Truckers bring goods from all over the American West to Lewiston for cheap transportation to the sea. If the dams were removed, the freight would have to go by train. There happen to be train tracks on both sides of the rivers going down, so it would not be that big a problem. It would just cost a bit more. But it would also eliminate some electricity production because four dams produce electricity, obviously. The argument on the other side is quite powerful, however. The four dams in the Lower Snake, before they were built, biologists knew they would be a disaster. They could just see that for salmon to get upstream from the Columbia through the Lower Snake into Idaho, into the mountains there, the dams would slow down the water too much. Their migration would be interrupted too much. They knew that it would probably lead to extinctions, and in fact it did, and it put several other species on the endangered list. Removal of the dams would solve that problem. The amount of electricity created by the dams is not so much that it couldn't be solved. Now there's so much more wind production and solar production coming online. And conservation also has made it possible perhaps to absorb the losses from those dams without causing a real significant jump in electricity prices. The estimates are a few pennies per month per consumer in the region to remove those dams. And the benefits long term for salmon and for salmon-related industries, like there's fishing and there's all kinds of recreation related to that, that in fact it may be a net economic win for the region. But there's incredible opposition, strong political opposition on the east side. And they view these dams as part of their political birthright, something that was given to them because they are rugged Western individualists. And if the dams were removed, they see it as federal interference in their lives, a completely unjustified disruption of their status quo that they depend on for the future. Politically, I still think that it's almost impossible to remove those dams unless there's a sea change in the thinking.
How is the management of the Columbia River currently controlled and by whom?
Well, it's controlled day-to-day operations by the Bonneville Power Administration, the Corps of Engineers, the Bureau of Reclamation, federal agencies. But it's also very much run on an annual basis by orders from Judge Redden. And it's unclear who will be his successor in running the river. A federal judge from the same district in Portland will take over sometime in the coming year. And it's unclear what the marching orders will be. This state of having the federal government constantly inveighing against these federal agencies has been the status quo in this region for 20 years, and it will likely continue forward. What's changed, though, is evidence that spilling water over the dams does increase salmon survival and return the river to something like a viable salmon highway, which is great, and it's very likely that that will become a permanent part of the system.
What do you predict for the future of the Columbia?
Well, I think it's a much more hopeful situation than it was 15 years ago, in part because they've learned how to manipulate the river in a way that keeps fish alive, which is something that the scientists were hopeful about 15 years ago, but they didn't really understand. There is a caveat to this. The survival of salmon in the river systems depends a lot on the conditions in the Pacific. They've been considered to be very good lately with excellent nutrition for salmon going in and out. They can change over time with ocean currents and the amount of nutrients available to salmon. It's not really clear whether this 4, 5, 6 years of good salmon returns is attributable to good ocean conditions or whether it's attributable to spilling more water over the dams and increasing the survival of fish as they try to get to the ocean. The scientists are working on that, but they tend to believe now that the evidence is strong that operating the dams in a way to get the fish down to the ocean will maintain the fish as much as possible given ocean conditions.
So the future of the river is much more hopeful than in the past. But also the value of hydro to the region has just continued to increase. The original decisions to take the Columbia River, and I should note that of all the rivers in North America, the Columbia is by far the best hydro resource. It contains one-third of the potential hydropower of the entire continent. So it's just an incredible resource. And it was developed early, and it's well run. And the system is providing, you know, more than half of the electricity used here. It keeps power costs low here. Because of the integration with wind power, which has come on like gangbusters in the past 10 years, it's increased like 30-fold in the past 10 years, and there's going to be another doubling probably in the next 5 to 6 years. The wind tends to blow actually in the river valleys and canyons. So most of the big wind farms have been constructed near the dams. So they can tie in to the high power lines that run to Seattle and Portland and connect up with California. And so it's been an incredibly efficient system. When the wind blows, and it blows a lot in the Pacific Northwest, particularly in eastern Washington, when the wind blows, they basically close down the dams, and the water behind the dams becomes the equivalent of a power storage battery. That water is potential power. And if the wind is blowing hard, you don't spill as much water, particularly in the winter when salmon aren't migrating. And so you keep more power in reserve, and the system becomes much more efficient because as soon as the wind stops blowing, they open up the dams. It's a synergistic system. Unlike anywhere in the world, this system is probably the neatest bit of non-polluting energy systems working together seamlessly. The one wrinkle in the system is that there have been so many wind turbines put up in the past 10 years that there's now not enough carrying capacity in the high power lines to take the power to market. Last summer, when the wind was blowing and the river was full of water from the spring spill-off, the BPA decided that in order to clear that water out of the river, which they needed to do, that they wouldn't buy power anymore from the wind turbines. And the wind turbine companies that had made an investment based on the idea that they're going to produce power whenever the wind blows, they were not selling power, so they couldn't pay their debts, and they were very angry. So what the federal government needs to do, and the utilities in the region, they need to invest more in transmission lines. That is going slowly. It should have been taken care of before.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the message about the Columbia River is that if you live in the Pacific Northwest, you're really lucky that it's there. It has made life cheaper, better for almost everybody, except, of course, for the Native Americans living up and down the river whose lives were dependent on salmon. They went through a horrible period. Now they're doing better because they've won in the courts and they're getting some fish back, and they're also getting some money to invest in other things. So for the Indians, it's sort of a qualified success in the past few years compared to what went before. But the energy situation in terms of non-polluting energy that does not contribute to global warming is really so much better in the Pacific Northwest because of the river system than anywhere else in the country. And I think it's a great thing.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Blaine.
My pleasure.
You have just been listening to Blaine Harden, author of the book, A River Lost, The Life and Death of the Columbia, revised and updated in 2012 and published by W.W. Norton & Company. For more information, check on the web at www.blaineharden.com. Again, that's BlaineHarden.com. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.